Chapter 28. Discipline and duty holding together the companies, the battalions, the regiments, the brigades, and divisions of an armed host. This body of men put its pride in preserving some semblance of order and formation. The only stragglers were those who fell out to give up to the frost their exhausted souls. They plodded on, and their passage did not disturb the mortal silence of the plains, shining with the livid light of snows under a sky the color of ashes. Whirlwinds ran along the fields, broke against the dark column, enveloped it in a turmoil of flying icicles, and subsided, disclosing it creeping on its tragic way without the swing and rhythm of the military pace. It struggled onwards, the men exchanging neither words nor looks. Whole ranks marched touching elbow, day after day, and never raising their eyes from the ground, as if lost in despairing reflections. In the dumb, black forests of pines the cracking of overloaded branches was the only sound they heard. Often from daybreak to dusk no one spoke in the whole column. It was like a macabre march of struggling corpses towards a distant grave. Only an alarm of Cossacks could restore to their eyes a semblance of martial resolution. The battalion faced about and deployed, or formed square under the endless fluttering of snowflakes. A cloud of horsemen with fur caps on their heads leveled long lances and yelled "Hurrah! Hurrah!" Around their menacing immobility whence, with muffled detonations, hundreds of dark red flames darted through the air thick with falling snow. In a very few moments the horsemen would disappear, as if carried off yelling in the gale, and the sacred battalion standing still, alone in the blizzard, heard only the howling of the wind, whose blasts searched their very hearts. Then, with a cry or two of "Vive l'Empereur," it would resume its march, leaving behind a few lifeless bodies lying huddled up, tiny black specks on the white immensity of the snows. Though often marching in the ranks, or skirmishing in the woods side by side, the two officers ignored each other, this not so much from inimical intention, as from a very real indifference. All their store of moral energy was expended in resisting the terrific enmity of nature, and the crushing sense of irretrievable disaster. To the last they counted among the most active, the least demoralized of the battalion. Their vigorous vitality invested them both with the appearance of an heroic pair in the eyes of their comrades. And they never exchanged more than a casual word or two, except one day, when skirmishing in front of the battalion against a worrying attack of cavalry, they found themselves cut off in the woods by a small party of Cossacks. A score of fur-capped, hairy horsemen rode to and fro, brandishing their lances in ominous silence. But the two officers had no mind to lay down their arms, and Colonel Farrod suddenly spoke up in a hoarse, growling voice, bringing his firelock to the shoulder. "Why, you take the nearest brute, Colonel Dubert. I'll settle the next one. I am a better shot than you are." Colonel Dubert nodded over his leveled musket. Their shoulders were pressed against the trunk of a large tree. On their front enormous snowdrifts protected them from a direct charge. Two carefully aimed shots rang out in the frosty air, two Cossacks reeled in their saddles. The rest, not thinking the game good enough, closed round their wounded comrades and galloped away out of range. The two officers managed to rejoin their battalion halted for the night. During that afternoon they had leaned upon each other more than once, and towards the end, Colonel Dubert, whose long legs gave him an advantage in walking through soft snow, peremptorily took the musket of Colonel Farrod from him, and carried it on his shoulder, using his own as a staff. On the outskirts of a village half buried in the snow an old wooden barn burned with a clear and an immense flame. The sacred battalion of skeletons, muffled in rags, crowded greedily the windward side, stretching hundreds of numbed bony hands to the blaze. Nobody had noted their approach. Before entering the circle of light playing on the sunken, glassy-eyed, starved faces, Colonel Dubert spoke in his turn. "Here's your musket, Colonel Farrod. I can walk better than you." Colonel Farrod nodded, and pushed on towards the warmth of the fierce flames. Colonel Dubert was more deliberate, but not the less bent on getting a place in the front rank. Those they shouldered aside tried to greet with a faint cheer the reappearance of the two indomitable companions in activity and endurance. Those manly qualities had never perhaps received a higher tribute than this feeble acclamation. This is the faithful record of speeches exchanged during the retreat from Moscow by Colonels Ferrod and Dubert. Colonel Ferrod's taciturnity was the outcome of concentrated rage. Short, hairy, black-faced, with layers of grime and the thick sprouting of a wiry beard, a frostbitten hand wrapped up in filthy rags carried in a sling, he accused fate of unparalleled perfidy towards the sublime man of destiny. Colonel Dubert, his long mustaches pendant in icicles on each side of his cracked blue lips, his eyelids inflamed with the glare of snows, the principal part of his costume consisting of a sheepskin coat looted with difficulty from the frozen corpse of a camp follower found in an abandoned cart, took a more thoughtful view of events. His regularly handsome features, now reduced to mere bony lines and fleshless hollows, looked out of a woman's black velvet hood, over which was rammed forcibly a cocked hat picked up under the wheels of an empty army furgon, which must have contained at one time some general officer's luggage. The sheepskin coat being short for a man of his inches ended very high up, and the skin of his legs, blue with the cold, showed through the tatters of his nether garments. This under the circumstances provoked neither jeers nor pity. No one cared how the next man felt or looked. Colonel Dubert himself, hardened to exposure, suffered mainly in his self-respect from the lamentable indecency of his costume. A thoughtless person may think that with a whole host of inanimate bodies bestrewing the path of retreat there could not have been much difficulty in supplying the deficiency. But to loot a pair of breeches from a frozen corpse is not so easy as it may appear to a mere theorist. It requires time and labor. You must remain behind while your companions march on. Colonel Dubert had his scruples as to falling out. Once he had stepped aside, he could not be sure of ever rejoining his battalion, and the ghastly intimacy of a wrestling match with the frozen dead opposing the unyielding rigidity of iron to your violence was repugnant to the delicacy of his feelings. Luckily, one day, grubbing in a mound of snow between the huts of a village in the hope of finding there a frozen potato or some vegetable garbage he could put between his long and shaky teeth, Colonel Dubert uncovered a couple of mats of the sort Russian peasants used to line the sides of their carts with. These, beaten free of frozen snow, bent about his elegant person and fastened solidly round his waist, made a bell-shaped nether garment, a sort of stiff petticoat, which rendered Colonel Dubert a perfectly decent, but a much more noticeable figure than before. Thus accoutred, he continued to retreat, never doubting of his personal escape, but full of other misgivings. The early buoyancy of his belief in the future was destroyed. If the road of glory led through such unforeseen passages, he asked himself, for he was reflective, whether the guide was altogether trustworthy. It was a patriotic sadness, not unmingled with some personal concern, and quite unlike the unreasoning indignation against men and things nursed by Colonel Ferrod. Recruiting his strength in a little German town for 3 weeks, Colonel Dubert was surprised to discover within himself a love of repose. His returning vigor was strangely pacific in its aspirations. He meditated silently upon this bizarre change of mood. No doubt many of his brother officers of field rank went through the same moral experience. But these were not the times to talk of it. In one of his letters home, Colonel Dubert wrote, "All your plans, my dear Leonie, for marrying me to the charming girl you have discovered in your neighborhood, seem farther off than ever. Peace is not yet. Europe wants another lesson. It will be a hard task for us, but it shall be done, because the Emperor is invincible." Thus wrote Colonel D. Hubert from Pomerania to his married sister Leonie, settled in the south of France. And so far the sentiments expressed would not have been disowned by Colonel Ferrod, who wrote no letters to anybody, whose father had been in life an illiterate blacksmith, who had no sister or brother, and whom no one desired ardently, to pair off for a life of peace with a charming young girl. But Colonel D. Hubert's letter contained also some philosophical generalities upon the uncertainty of all personal hopes, when bound up entirely with the prestigious fortune of one incomparably great, it is true, yet still remaining, but a man in his greatness. This view would have appeared rank heresy to Colonel Farrod. Some melancholy forebodings of a military kind, expressed cautiously, would have been pronounced as nothing short of high treason by Colonel Farrod. But Leonie, the sister of Colonel Dubert, read them with profound satisfaction, and, folding the letter thoughtfully, remarked to herself that Arm, and was likely to prove eventually a sensible fellow. Since her marriage into a southern family, she had become a convinced believer in the return of the legitimate king. Hopeful and anxious, she offered prayers night and morning, and burnt candles in churches for the safety and prosperity of her brother. As he had every reason to suppose, that her prayers were heard. Colonel Dubert passed through Lutzen, Bautzen, and Leipzig losing no limb, and acquiring additional reputation. Adapting his conduct to the needs of that desperate time, he had never voiced his misgivings. He concealed them under a cheerful courtesy of such pleasant character, that people were inclined to ask themselves with wonder, whether Colonel Dubert was aware of any disasters. Not only his manners, but even his glances remained untroubled. The steady amenity of his blue eyes disconcerted all grumblers, and made despair itself pause. This bearing was remarked favorably by the Emperor himself, for Colonel Dubert, attached now to the Major General's staff, came on several occasions under the Imperial eye, but it exasperated the higher-strung nature of Colonel Farrod. Passing through Magdeburg on service, this last allowed himself, while seated gloomily at dinner with the Commandant de Plas, to say of his lifelong adversary, "This man does not love the Emperor," and his words were received by the other guests in profound silence. Colonel Farrod, troubled in his conscience at the atrocity of the aspersion, felt the need to back it up by a good argument. "I ought to know him," he cried, adding some oaths. "One studies one's adversary. I have met him on the ground half a dozen times, as all the army knows. What more do you want? If that isn't opportunity enough for any fool to size up his man, may the devil take me, if I can tell what is." And he looked around the table, obstinate and somber. Later on in Paris, while extremely busy reorganizing his regiment, Colonel Farrod learned that Colonel Dubert had been made a general. He glared at his informant incredulously, then folded his arms and turned away muttering, "Nothing surprises me on the part of that man." And aloud he added, speaking over his shoulder, "You would oblige me greatly by telling General Dubert at the first opportunity that his advancement saves him for a time from a pretty hot encounter. I was only waiting for him to turn up here." The other officer remonstrated. "Could you think of it, Colonel Farrod, at this time, when every life should be consecrated to the glory and safety of France?" But the strain of unhappiness caused by military reverses had spoiled Colonel Farrod's character. Like many other men, he was rendered wicked by misfortune. "I cannot consider General Dubert's existence of any account either for the glory or safety of France," he snapped viciously. "Why, you don't pretend, perhaps, to know him better than I do, I who have met him half a dozen times on the ground, do you?" His interlocutor, a young man, was silenced. Colonel Farrod walked up and down the room. "This is not the time to mince matters," he said. I can't believe that man ever loved the Emperor. He picked up his general's stars under the boots of Marshal Berthier. "Very well. I'll get mine in another fashion, and then we shall settle this business which has been dragging on too long." General Dubert, informed indirectly of Colonel Farrod's attitude, made a gesture, as if to put aside an importunate person. His thoughts were solicited by graver cares. He had had no time to go and see his family. His sister, whose royalist hopes were rising higher every day, though proud of her brother, regretted his recent advancement in a measure, because it put on him a prominent mark of the usurper's favor, which later on could have an adverse influence upon his career. He wrote to her that no one but an inveterate enemy could say he had got his promotion by favor. As to his career, he assured her that he looked no farther forward into the future than the next battlefield. Beginning the campaign of France in this dogged spirit, General Dubert was wounded on the second day of the battle under Lannes. While being carried off the field, he heard that Colonel Ferraud, promoted this moment to general, had been sent to replace him at the head of his brigade. He cursed his luck impulsively, not being able at the first glance to discern all the advantages of a nasty wound. And yet it was by this heroic method that Providence was shaping his future. Traveling slowly south to his sister's country home under the care of a trusty old servant, General Dubert was spared the humiliating contacts and the perplexities of conduct which assailed the men of Napoleonic Empire at the moment of its downfall. Lying in his bed, with the windows of his room open wide to the sunshine of Provence, he perceived the undisguised Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.